If you
carry it,
can,
don't worry.
oh, you know what? I'll see if I can. All right. Okay, folks, Pastor Eli James here. Having technical difficulties. My keyboard seems to have failed and I can't type anything. But Ted Midward and I are ready to roll, and we're going to do another episode on Abe Lincoln. And I think we're almost done with his racial views. But go ahead, pick it up, Ted.
Yeah, good afternoon to everyone out there. I've got a echo in my ear here. Let me see what I got going on.
Okay.
But yeah, we're on episode three here. We've been covering, and we're going to continue to cover these various topics of the Civil War. That there's a lot of small nuances and details and different views, and I know a lot of people feel very strongly one way or the other about the Civil War issue. Okay, so we're just going to take our time and week by week sort of wade through all this. I know Eli has done shows in the past, particularly about how the Rothschilds orchestrated this whole Civil War scenario from behind the scenes, and we're eventually going to get there. We wanted to cover the American Colonization Society first, and we wanted to dispel a lot of the myths that people have about Abraham Lincoln, about the Republican Party, about the North,
Right, and the South.
and the South too. And we'll get there and we'll cover everything. But the old saying holds true, folks. The victors write the history books, and no one is ever, like Adolf Hitler pointed out, no one is ever going to ask, stop and ask, well, were you guys right or wrong? That's all going to be water under the bridge. So a lot of this, folks, take any other issue out there, the world wars, banking, where once again with this subject, we're going to see the abject failure of modern academia and modern historians, past and present, and how shameful and derelict in their duty they have been with this topic, in particular with respect to Abraham Lincoln and his views on the peculiar institution, quote unquote, of the South, slavery and African slaves. And we're reading this article. It goes into a lot of detail. It's got all the footnotes, all the quotes that we want to hit. But the title of it, once again, for folks, we started it last week. It's called The Great Emancipator and the Issue of Race, Abraham Lincoln's Program of Black Resettlement. This is authored by Robert Morgan, and this particular article, it's hosted on the Institute for Historical Review. And I, going off memory from years ago, I believe that's Mark Weber. I don't know if Mark Weber is still around, but he's done some excellent work. There's great articles on this site, folks. The Institute for Historical Review. Punch that in when you have some free time and browse around. You'll love the content on there for the listeners.
And okay, so is this the Peoria speech? Because my keyboard has failed, so I can't type anything into the chat room, but my mouse is working, and so I have to scroll up to find the article and to look at it myself. Is this the Great Emancipator from IHR?
Yes,
Okay.
let me
Yeah, I've
send
got
this
it.
directly to you
Yeah, I've got it.
so you can look up. Okay.
So where did we leave off?
We left off. I'll backtrack a little bit from last week. We are maybe a fifth of the page down. We're getting into Lincoln's correspondence with Alexander H. Stephens. He was the vice president of the Confederacy. So I don't know if I can send you a bookmark of exactly where we're at, Eli, but I will pick it up and read this. And once again, if you want to stop me at any point and comment, feel free to do so. We have plenty of time.
Well, I know we covered the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and I'm pretty sure we covered the basic, the true cause of the Civil War was that Northerners objected to the expansion of slavery west. Okay? So
Correct.
Lincoln had no problem with maintaining slavery in the states where it existed, but the Northerners did not want, for many reasons, but for a main reason, They do not want blacks coming into the North. Okay, they've had enough of that already with the Underground Railroad and etc. Okay, so that was the true. That was where the House was divided. Okay, all right, back to you.
Right. So this author that we're reading, he's got these great excerpts and quotes from these various speeches and occasions where Lincoln spoke. And one of them, I didn't stop. I wanted to keep reading last week, but one of them rang a bell with me. I believe one of them was from his reaction to the Dred Scott case, which me and you read on air years ago, Eli.
Right.
He pointed out that, you know, I'd rather the white and the Negro race never come into contact in the first place. That's
right.
My position.
Yeah,
and this was a big. You're never going to hear this, folks. This almost dropped my jaw when this finally made sense to me. That a lot of the Northerners oppose the quote unquote abolitionist crowd. They oppose slavery just for this fact. They did not want Negro slaves anywhere in their proximity. They wanted a free white nation for free white labor from the Atlantic to the Pacific, folks.
That's right. That's right. But that was not true of the radical abolitionists in the Northeast. They wanted racial integration. That's what they were for. Okay. And Lincoln was opposed to them as well. Okay. All right. Back to you.
So I'll pick up back with the text. We've got a ways to go. but I like this article, despite its length, because it has all the elements, all the quotes that I tried to single-handedly go on a go on a wild goose chase to collect, and I found most of them in this. So we can make our way through this. We left off with like I said, Lincoln corresponds with Alexander H. Stephens, who's the vice president under Jefferson Davis of the Confederate States of America. And the liberals run wild with the cornerstone speech, they call it, of Alexander H. Stephens, where he flat out admits, you know, white supremacy and whites ruling over blacks in servitude is the cornerstone of the Confederacy and their foundational philosophy for government. Liberals and blacks run wild with that on the internet. And like we pointed out before, folks, neo-Confederates, you have to stop sidestepping the issue of race and slavery. So
for sure,
let me pick up and go on. So this is Lincoln and Alexander H. Stephens. Lincoln also addressed the decisive issue in correspondence with Alexander H. Stephens, who would soon become vice president of the Confederacy. Stephens was an old and much admired acquaintance of Lincoln's, a one-time fellow Whig and congressman. Having seen reports of a pro-Union speech in Georgia by Stephens, Lincoln wrote to express his thanks. Stephens responded with a request that the president-elect strike a blow on behalf of Southern Unionists by clearly expressing his views. In a private letter dated December 22, 1860, Lincoln replied saying this, "Do the people of the South really entertain fears that a Republican administration would, directly or indirectly, interfere with their slaves or with them about their slaves? If they do, I wish to assure you, as once a friend and still, I hope, not an enemy, there is no cause for such fears." So Lincoln's writing to Stephens here, trying to calm Southerners down. This is after the John Brown raid. This is after Lincoln's winning the president's winning the election, not inaugurated yet. But the South is running wild. They're scared to death. Southern newspapers publish reports that John Brown and the radical abolitionists who are trying to stir up Negro revolts, they're corresponding with people in the Republican Party like William Seward. And the South is publishing these in their newspapers, and they're telling them the Republicans want to end slavery. Well, some of them probably did. The radical abolitionists, there's no doubt, did.
Yes.
Lincoln, I believe, the evidence will show, Lincoln and many other Republicans were content to leave it in the southeast corner of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the Southeast Conference. That's where it belongs.
Right.
Okay.
And let me just this is popping into my head. Let me just sort of back that up. In 1819, Alabama, is up for vote before Congress to be admitted as a state into the Union. Okay. It goes in without any consternation, without any fighting. It is admitted to the Union as a, of course, in the South, it is a slave state. No one from the North bats an eye. No one makes a fight. They all kind of accept, okay, yes, it's a deep South state. It's mm-hmm. right next to neighboring Southern slave states. It's not a big deal to admit them as one. However, right. a year later, 1820, the state of Missouri wants to be admitted into the Union, and this causes a big fiasco in the Congress. Will it be free? Will it be a slave state?
Right.
This Western – you got to take this and look into this, folks. No one's going to tell you this outright. The Western spread of slavery is what causes a lot of the consternation.
Right.
So continuing on with the text here, Lincoln went on to sum up the issue as he saw it, saying this: "You think slavery is right and ought to be extended, while we think it is wrong and ought to be restricted. That, I suppose, is the rub. It certainly is the only substantial difference between us."
Okay.
This is him writing to Alexander Stephens. So once again, we have it. The extension of slavery is what causes the problem.
That's right.
They do not want it west. Continuing on with the text. To Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Tribune, who had passed along a report of a rabid anti-Lincoln harangue in the Mississippi legislature,
ooh.
Lincoln wrote that this, quote, madman, Greeley, that he had quite misrepresented his views.
Mm-hmm.
He stated he was not, quote unquote, pledged to the ultimate extinction of slavery, and that he did not, quote, hold the black man to be equal to that of the white.
There you go.
When a Mississippian appeared at a reception for Lincoln in the Illinois State House and boldly announced he was a secessionist, Lincoln responded by saying that he was opposed to any interference with slavery where it existed. He gave the same sort of general assurance to a number of callers and correspondents. He also wrote a few anonymous editorials for the Illinois State Journal, the Republican newspaper of Springfield. Additionally, he composed a few lines for a speech delivered by Senator Trumbull at the Republican victory celebration in Springfield on November 20th. In those lines, Lincoln pledged that each and all of the states would be left in as complete control of their own affairs as ever. Now we move on in the text. This is the inauguration.
Okay, so
Eli, did you want to pop in?
Yeah, well, that comment by Horace Greeley was clearly false information. And, you know, people will pick it up. See, here's this Horace Greeley saying that Lincoln favors racial integration and he's an out-and-out anti-slavery candidate. And that just isn't true. I mean, it's like today we have nothing but lies coming from the left constantly, and a lot of misunderstanding from the right, not perceiving what the real situation is, okay? So you have to picture the northern white folks who were primarily farmers and workers, except for the eastern liberal establishment, which was largely bankers and merchandisers. These people simply did not want blacks moving into their neighborhood, and number one, to take their jobs away from them, and number two, they did not want to live among them because they considered the blacks radically different and cannot live together. Okay, and that's what Lincoln expressed constantly.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Abraham Lincoln took the oath of president on March 4th, 1861. Among the first words of his inaugural address was a pledge, repeating words from an August 1858 speech, intended to placate Southern apprehensions. He said this: "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." Referring to the proposed Crittenden Amendment, which would make explicit constitutional protection of slavery where it had already existed, he said this: I have no objection to its being made express and irrevocable. He also promised to support legislation for the capture and return of runaway slaves. At the same time, though, Lincoln emphasized that no state, upon its own mere motion, can lawfully get out of the Union. With regard to those states that already proclaimed their secession from the Union, he said, "I shall take care, as the Constitution itself expressly enjoins upon me, that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states. Doing this, I deem to be only a simple duty on my part, and I shall perform it so far as practicable, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall withhold the requisite means, or, in some authoritative manner, direct the contrary."
Okay, well, this was a huge bone of contention, more than actually any of the other things, whether or not the federal government can prevent a state from leaving the Union. And there's a lot of pros and cons about that. And I personally don't have any objection to it. I think the reasoning comes from, not from the Constitution, but from the, what was it, the convention that they had before the U.S. Constitution, that the Constitution had to beef up. But I think statements to that effect were made in the previous Constitution.
Articles of Confederation?
Yes, Articles of Confederation, that anyone who joins cannot leave of his own accord. Now, that does not say that they can't be voted out, okay? But once the shooting had started, then the time for disputation over the Constitution was over.
Correct, yes. And we can get into that more, and I'm sure we will in future episodes. We're going to try to hit all this, folks.
Yeah.
Continuing on with this, with the text here. In his masterful multi-volume study of the background and course of the Civil War, American historian Alan Nevins attempted to identify the conflict's principal underlying cause. He said this: "The main root of the conflict, and there were minor roots, was the problem of slavery with its complementary problem of race adjustment. The main source of the tragedy was the refusal of either section to face these conjoined problems squarely and pay the heavy costs of a peaceful settlement. Had it not been for the difference in race, the slavery issue would have presented no great difficulties. But as the racial gulf existed, the South inarticulately but clearly perceived that elimination of this issue would still leave it with the terrible problem of the Negro.
Right.
A heavy responsibility for the failure of America in this period rests with this Southern leadership, which lacked imagination, ability, and courage. But the North was by no means without its full share, for the North equally refused to give a constructive examination to the central question of slavery as linked with race adjustment. This was because of two principal reasons. Most abolitionists and many other sentimental-minded Northerners simply denied that the problem existed.
Okay.
Regarding all Negroes as white men with dark skins, whom a few years of schooling would bring abreast of the dominant race, they thought that no difficult adjustment was required. A much more numerous body of Northerners would have granted that a great and terrible task of race adjustment existed, but they were reluctant to help shoulder any part of it. Indiana, Illinois, and even Kansas were unwilling to take a single additional person of color."
There you go. Big difference between the Midwest and the East, especially the Northeast, yeah.
Moving on to the outbreak of war. Dramatic events were swiftly creating enormous problems for the new president, who had greatly underestimated the depth of secessionist feeling in the South. In January and early February, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas followed South Carolina's example and left the Union. Florida troops fired on the federal stronghold of Fort Pickens. When South Carolina seceded, she claimed as rightfully hers all U.S. government property within her borders, including federal forts and arsenals. While announcing a willingness to pay the federal government for at least a share of the cost of improvements it had made, South Carolina insisted that these properties belonged to the state and would no longer tolerate the presence of a foreign power upon her soil. The other newly seceding states took the same position. On the day Lincoln took the presidential oath, the federal government still controlled four forts inside the new Confederacy. In Florida, there were forts Taylor, Jefferson, and Pickens, the first two of which seemed secure, while in South Carolina there was Fort Sumter, which was almost entirely encircled by hostile forces. While historians do not agree whether Lincoln deliberately sought to provoke an attack by his decision to resupply the fort, it is known that on April 9th, while the bombardment of the stronghold was underway, the new president received a delegation of Virginia Unionists at the White House. Lincoln reminded them of his inaugural pledge that there would be no invasion, not using force, beyond what was necessary to hold federal government sites and to collect customs duties. But if, as now appeared to be true, an unprovoked assault had been made upon Fort Sumter, I shall hold myself at liberty to repossess, if I can, like places which have been seized before the government was devolved upon me.
Yeah, no. A lot of these seizures took place before Lincoln became president.
Correct. And, yeah. You know, just from reading sort of the background, the who was the president prior to Lincoln? Buchanan, James
right.
Buchanan.
Mm-hmm.
He and I think John Breckinridge was his vice president, correct? He very pro-Southern sympathies in the White House in the Buchanan
right.
administration. And I believe they declined amidst all this tension building. They declined to reinforce or resupply these federal bases in the South. They kind of just let it go.
Right. It's Lincoln's problem now.
right.
Okay.
Interestingly, the liberals hate James Buchanan. I think they claim he's the worst president we had. They absolutely cannot stand him. True. And there are quotes from James Buchanan, folks. You can look it up, that he blames the North for a lot of the Civil War tension, that they could not stop the abolitionist agitation. They couldn't let it go. And there's quotes of him saying this and blaming them for it. Interesting.
Yeah, but that only is accurate with regard to the radical abolitionists. And they were backed
correct.
By big money. And it's right. hard to stop big money. Yeah.
Okay, continuing on with the text here. In the aftermath of the Confederate seizure of Fort Sumter in mid-April, Lincoln called upon the states to provide 75,000 soldiers to put down the rebellion. Virginia, Tennessee, Arkansas, and North Carolina responded by leaving the Union and joining the newly formed Confederate States of America. This increased the size of the Confederacy by a third and almost doubled its population and economic resources. Remaining with the Union, though, were four slaveholding border states: Delaware, Missouri, Maryland, and Kentucky, and, predictably, the slaveholding District of Columbia. The American Civil War of 1861 to 1865, or this quote-unquote war between the states, as many Southerners call it, eventually claimed the lives of 360,000 in the Union forces and an estimated 258,000 among the Confederates, in addition to hundreds of thousands of maimed and wounded. It was by far the most destructive war in American history. Even after fighting began in earnest, Lincoln stuck to his long-held position on the slavery issue by countermanding orders by Union generals to free slaves. In July 1861, General John C. Fremont, the Republican Party's unsuccessful 1856 presidential candidate, declared martial law in Missouri and announced that all slaves of owners in the state who opposed the Union were free. President Lincoln immediately canceled the order. Because the southern states no longer sent representatives to Washington, abolitionists and radical Republicans wield exceptional power in Congress, which responded to Lincoln's cancellation of Fremont's order by passing on August 6, 1861, the first, it's noted here in parentheses, the first Confiscation Act. It provided that any property, including slaves, used with the owner's consent in aiding and abetting insurrection against the United States was the lawful subject of prize and capture wherever found.
Yeah, and that's where Lincoln disagreed. You know, he stuck by the Constitution and said, I cannot interfere with the institution of slavery where it already exists. But again, the radical abolitionists from the Northeast, they were stirring up trouble. And John C. Fremont of Missouri was in, I don't know if he was in league with them or just sympathized with them, but he countermanded Lincoln's precise, you know, instructions not to free any slaves in where they exist already. Okay.
In May 1862, Union General David Hunter issued an order declaring all slaves in Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina to be free. Lincoln promptly revoked the order.
Right.
An irate Congress responded by passing in July a second Confiscation Act that declared, quote unquote, forever free all slaves whose owners were in rebellion, whether or not the slaves were used for military purposes. Lincoln refused to sign the act until it was amended, stating he thought it an unconditional bill of attainder. Although he did not veto the amended law, Lincoln expressed his dissatisfaction with it. Furthermore, he did not faithfully enforce either of the Confiscation Acts.
Very good.
Moving on to deaths in Union contraband camps. Slaves seized under the Confiscation Acts, as well as runaway slaves who turned themselves in to Union forces, were held in so-called contraband camps. In his message to the Confederate Congress in the fall of 1863, President Jefferson Davis sharply criticized Union treatment of these blacks. After describing the starvation and suffering in these camps, he said, "There is little hazard in predicting that in all localities where the enemy have a temporary foothold, the Negroes, who under our care increased sixfold, will have been reduced by mortality during the war to no more than one half their previous number." However exaggerated Davis's words may have been, it remains a grim fact that many blacks lost their lives in these internment camps, and considerably more suffered terribly as victims of hunger, exposure, and neglect. In 1864, one Union officer called the death rate in these camps frightful and said that most competent judges place it as no less than 25% in the last 2 years.
Okay.
Moving on to the, I'm going to butcher this word, but I'm going to call it the Chiriqui Resettlement Plan.
Okay.
Even before he took office, Lincoln was pleased to note widespread public support for colonization of the country's blacks. In 1861 to 1862, there was widespread support among conservative Republicans and Democrats for the colonization abroad of Negroes emancipated by the war. This was a quote by historian James M. McPherson. He's a pretty popular author on the Civil War out there. Okay. At the same time, free blacks in parts of the North were circulating a petition asking Congress to purchase a tract of land in Central America as a site for their resettlement. In spite of the pressing demands imposed by the war, Lincoln soon took time to implement his long-standing plan for resettling blacks outside the United States. Ambrose W. Thompson, a Philadelphian who had grown rich in coastal shipping, provided the new president with what seemed to be a good opportunity. Thompson had obtained control of several hundred thousand acres in the Chiriqui region of what is now Panama, and had formed the Chiriqui Improvement Company. He proposed transporting liberated blacks from the United States to the Central American region, where they would mine the coal that was supposedly there in abundance. This coal would be sold to the U.S. Navy, with the resulting profits used to sustain the black colony, including development of plantations of cotton, sugar, coffee, and rice. The Chiriqui project would also help to extend U.S. commercial dominance over tropical America. Negotiations to realize the plan began in May 1861, and on August 8th, Thompson made a formal proposal to Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles to deliver coal from Chiriqui at one half the price the government was then paying. Meanwhile, Lincoln had referred the proposal to his brother-in-law, Ninian W. Edwards, who on August 9, 1861, enthusiastically endorsed the proposed contract. Appointing a commission to investigate the Thompson proposal, Lincoln referred its findings to Francis P. Blair Sr., endorsing a government contract with the Chiriqui Improvement Company even more strongly than Edwards had. The senior Blair believed the main purpose of such a contract should be to utilize the area controlled by Thompson to, quote, solve the black question.
Ah, a final solution.
Right.
There we go. All right.
He repeated Jefferson's view that blacks would ultimately have to be deported from the United States.
There you go.
And reviewed Lincoln's own endorsement of resettlement and discussed the activities of his son, Missouri Representative Francis P. Blair Jr., on behalf of deportation. Blair concluded his lengthy report with a recommendation that Henry T. Blow, U.S. Minister to Venezuela, be sent to Chiriqui to make an examination for the government. Lincoln ordered his Secretary of War, Simon Cameron, to release Thompson from his military duties so he could escort Henry T. Blow to Central America. And there's a quote here, a little excerpt. For the purpose of reconnaissance of and a report upon the lands and harbors of the Isthmus of Chiriqui, the fitness of the lands to the colonization of the Negro race, the practicability of connecting the said harbors by a railroad, and the works which will be necessary for the Chiriqui Company to erect to protect the colonists as they may arrive, as well as for the protection and defense of the harbors at the terminal of said road. Mm-hmm. Simon Cameron was to provide Thompson with the necessary equipment and assistance. The mission was to be carried out under sealed orders with every precaution for secrecy, because Lincoln did not have legal authority to undertake such an expedition.
Okay, that's interesting. I wonder, well, it's a business deal, right?
Yes.
Okay.
In the middle of a war.
Right, in the middle of a war.
Lincoln finds time for it. Very telling.
Yeah, but I don't see that it's illegal for him to do that, because his stated purpose was to recolonize the blacks away from America. And everybody knew it. The South denied it, or at least portions of the South denied it. So, they're an obvious problem for the nation. I don't see why that would be illegal. I don't. But back to you.
Continuing on with the text here, while Henry T. Blow was investigating this Chiriqui area, Lincoln called Delaware Congressman George Fisher to the White House in November 1861 to discuss compensated emancipation of the slaves in that small state, where the 1860 census had enumerated only 507 slaveholders owning fewer than a total of 1,800 slaves. The president asked Fisher to determine whether the Delaware legislature could be persuaded to free slaves in the state if the government compensated the owners for them. Once the plan proved feasible in Delaware, the president hoped he might be able to persuade the other border states and eventually even the secessionist states to adopt it. With assistance from Lincoln, Fisher drew up a bill to be presented to the state legislature when it met in late December. It provided that when the federal government had appropriated money to pay an average of $500 for each slave, emancipation would go into effect. As soon as it was made public, though, an acrimonious debate broke out, with party rancor and pro-slavery sentiment combining to defeat the proposed legislation.
Yeah, I don't know about party rancor. Certainly the radical abolitionists would have objected. Okay. So what most people don't realize is that Lincoln was fighting a battle on two fronts, the slaveholding South, which wanted to maintain slavery, and the radical abolitionists who wanted to promote racial integration. These two camps opposed Lincoln constantly during the Civil War. And a lot of people aren't aware that the radical abolitionists in the Northeast were really one of his major enemies. They gave him more trouble in Congress than anybody else. Okay.
Moving on to the next session, this is entitled Absolute Necessity. In his first annual message to Congress on December 3, 1861, President Lincoln proposed that persons liberated by the fighting should be deemed free and that, in any event, steps be taken for colonizing them at some place or places in a climate congenial to them. It might be well to consider, too, whether the free colored people already in the United States could not, so far as individuals may desire, be included in such colonization. This effort, Lincoln recognized, may involve the acquiring of territory and also the appropriation of money beyond that to be expended in the territorial acquisition. Some form of resettlement, he said, amounts to an absolute necessity.
Amen.
I will add here, too, that I was just going over this. There's a quote from Daniel Webster, a big-time senator in the 19th century. He was from Massachusetts. He was part of the American Colonization Society. There's a quote in that Ernest Sevier Cox book, Lincoln's Negro Policy, and it has Webster saying on the Senate floor, "Gentlemen, there's no amount of money that I won't approve for colonization. You go ahead and get it done. I'll approve it."
Yeah, there you go. This is okay. a completely blacked out aspect of Civil War history.
Right.
Yeah.
Moving on to the next section of the article, this is entitled Growing Clamor for Emancipation. Lincoln's faithful enforcement of the fugitive slave law not only filled Washington, D.C. jails with runaway slaves waiting to be claimed by their owners, but also enraged many who loathed slavery. In an effort to appease his party's abolitionist faction, Lincoln urged that the United States formally recognize the Black Republics of Haiti and Liberia, a proposal that Congress accepted. Lincoln realized that the growing clamor to abolish slavery threatened to seriously jeopardize the support he needed to prosecute the war to preserve the Union. Accordingly, on March 6, 1862, he called on Congress to endorse a carefully worded resolution. And here is the excerpt. Resolved that the United States ought to cooperate with any state which may adopt gradual abolishment of slavery, giving to such state pecuniary aid to be used by such state in its discretion to compensate for the inconvenience, public and private, produced by such change of system. In a letter to New York Times editor Henry J. Raymond urging support for the resolution, Lincoln explained that $1 million, or less than a half day's cost of the war, would buy all the slaves in Delaware, and that $174 million, or less than 87 days' cost of the war, would purchase all the slaves in the border states and the District of Columbia. Although the resolution lacked authority of law and was merely a declaration of intent, it alarmed representatives from the loyal slaveholding border states. Missouri Congressman Frank P. Blair Jr., who in 1868 would campaign as the Democratic Party's vice presidential candidate, spoke against the resolution in a speech in the House on April 11, 1862. Emancipation of the slaves, he warned, would be a terrible mistake until arrangements were first made to resettle the blacks abroad. Blair spoke of shipping them to areas south of the Rio Grande.
Okay.
In spite of such opposition, though, moderate Republicans and Democrats joined to approve the resolution, which was passed by Congress and signed by Lincoln on April 10th, 1862. Not a single border state lawmaker had voted for the measure, however. In an effort to assuage such concerns, in July, Lincoln called border state congressmen and senators to a White House meeting, at which he explained that the recently passed resolution involved no claim of federal authority over slavery in the states, and that it left the issue under state control. Seeking to calm fears that emancipation would suddenly result in many freed Negroes in their midst, he again spoke of resettlement of blacks as the solution. Room in South America for colonization can be obtained cheaply and in abundance, said the president. And when the numbers shall be large enough to be company and encouragement for one another, the freed people will not be so reluctant to go, he said.
Right. They can party like blacks. Right.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Moving on to the next section here, this is Congress votes funds for resettlement. In 1860, the 3,185 slaves in the District of Columbia were owned by just 2% of the district's residents. In April 1862, Lincoln arranged to have a bill introduced in Congress that would compensate district slaveholders an average of $300 for each slave. An additional $100,000 was appropriated to be expended under the direction of the President of the United States to aid in the colonization and settlement of such free persons of African descent now residing in said district, including those to be liberated by this act, as may desire to emigrate to the Republic of Haiti or Liberia, or such other country beyond the limits of the United States as the president may determine.
So he took Blair's advice. You have to make sure that no such funds will be provided unless it makes them resettle, okay, in other countries.
Right.
Yeah.
And not just recently emancipated slaves, folks. Free blacks, too.
Yeah, right. And there were a whole lot of them, not too many in the North, but primarily in the state of Virginia, where blacks who were too old and too illiterate to be of any use to the state, right? Whose fault is that? That was the primary. The freed blacks there in the South were becoming a nuisance to the white residents there. Okay, back to you.
When he signed the bill into law on April 16th, Lincoln stated, "I am gratified that the two principles of compensation and colonization are both recognized and practically applied in this act." 2 months later, as part of the second Confiscation Act of July 1862, Congress appropriated an additional $500,000 for the president's use in resettling blacks who came under Union military control. rejecting criticism from the prominent radicals, such as Senator Charles Sumner, most senators and representatives expressed support for the bold project in a joint resolution declaring that the president is hereby authorized to make provision for the transportation, colonization, and settlement in some tropical country beyond the limits of the United States of such persons of African race, made free by the provisions of this act, as may be willing to emigrate.
Okay.
Lincoln now had congressional authority and $600,000 in authorized funds to proceed with his plan for resettlement. Obstacles. Serious obstacles remained, however. Secretary of the Interior, Caleb B. Smith, informed the president that Liberia was out of the question as a destination for resettling blacks because of the inhospitable climate, the unwillingness of blacks to travel so far, and the great expense involved in transporting people such a vast distance. Haiti was ruled out because of the low level of civilization there, because Catholic influence was so strong there, and because of fears that the Spanish might soon take control of the Caribbean country. Those blacks who had expressed a desire to emigrate, Secretary Smith went on to explain, preferred to remain in the Western Hemisphere. The only really acceptable site was Chiriquis, Smith concluded, because of its relative proximity to the United States and because of the availability of coal there. Meanwhile, the United States minister in Brazil expressed the view that the country's abundance of land and shortage of labor made it a good site for resettling America's blacks. In mid-May 1862, Lincoln received a paper from Reverend James Mitchell that laid out arguments for resettling the country's black population. And here's an excerpt. Our Republican system was meant for a homogeneous people. As long as blacks continue to live with the whites, they constitute a threat to the national life. Family life may also collapse, and the increase of mixed-breed bastards may someday challenge the supremacy of the white man.
You think?
Boy, he nailed it, didn't he?
He sure did.
He saw the future.
Yeah.
Mitchell went on to recommend the gradual deportation of America's blacks to Central America and Mexico. That region had once known a great empire and could become one again, he stated. This continent could then be divided between a race of mixed bloods and Anglo-Americans. Lincoln was apparently impressed with Mitchell's arguments. A short time later, he appointed him as Commissioner of Emigration. That's emigration with an E, folks, not an
right.
I.
Right.
So moving on to the next section in the article, this is a historic White House meeting. Eager to proceed with the Chiriquis project on August 14th, 1862, Lincoln met with five free black ministers for the first time a delegation of their race was invited to the White House on a matter of public policy. The president made no effort to engage in conversation with the visitors, who were bluntly informed that they had been invited to listen. Lincoln did not mince words, but candidly told the group this, and this is going to be long, so bear with me here. This is okay. Four or five paragraphs. You and we are different races. We have between us a broader difference than exists between almost any other two races. Whether it is right or wrong, I need not discuss. But this physical difference is a great disadvantage to us both, as I think your race suffers very greatly, many of them, by living among us, while ours suffers from your presence. In a word, we suffer on each side. If this is admitted, it affords a reason at least why we should be separated. Even when you cease to be slaves, you are yet far removed from being placed on an equality with the white race.
What?
The aspiration of men is to enjoy equality with the best when free, but on this broad continent, not a single man of your race is made the equal of a single man of ours. Go where you are treated the best, and the ban is still upon you. We look to our condition, owing to the existence of the two races on this continent. I need not recount to you the effects upon white men growing out of the institution of slavery. I believe in its general evil effects on the white race. See our present condition, the country engaged in war, our white men cutting one another's throats, none knowing how far it will extend. And then consider what we know to be the truth. But for your race among us, there could not be war. Although many men engaged on either side do not care for you one way or the other. Nevertheless, right. I repeat, without the institution of slavery and the colored race as a basis, the war would not have an existence.
There you go.
It is better for us both, therefore, to be separated.
How could he say such a thing? Right. Liberals would be aghast if they knew these things. Absolutely right. Aghast. Okay.
Old Honest Abe, the great emancipator. Yeah,
there you go. Right.
Now, I have read about this instance from another article and from other websites. And apparently Frederick Douglass, he was here at this meeting and he was pissed after hearing this.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He wrote about it and he said, no, we're Americans just like you.
Oh, right.
He did not want to have it one bit.
Yeah. I can tell you my personal experience with blacks in Chicago, their view is because they were born in this country, they are therefore Americans, but that's not what the Constitution says. Okay, you have to be of the white race. Up until the 14th Amendment, you had to be of the white race to be a citizen. So the 14th Amendment is what undid our racial separation. Okay, back to you.
Correct. So that's the end of what Lincoln actually told this group of five free black ministers at this White House meeting. So continue on with the text.
Stephen Douglas was a half-breed. Okay. So maybe that's why he objected. I'm part white. Give me a break. Okay.
So continuing on here, it says, an excellent site for black resettlement, Lincoln went on, was available in Central America. It had good harbors and an abundance of coal that would permit the colony to be quickly put on a firm financial footing. The president concluded by asking the delegation to determine if a number of freedmen with their families would be willing to go as soon as arrangements could be made. Mm-hmm. Organizing black support. The next day, Reverend Mitchell, who attended this historic White House meeting as Lincoln's commissioner of immigration, placed an advertisement in northern newspapers announcing, correspondence is desired with colored men favorable to Central America, Liberian or Haitian immigration, especially the first named. Mitchell also sent a memorandum to black ministers urging them to use their influence to encourage emigration. Providence itself, he wrote, had decreed a separate existence for the races.
There you go.
Blacks were half responsible for the terrible Civil War, Mitchell went on, and forecast further bloodshed unless they left the country. He concluded saying this, "This is a nation of equal white laborers, and as you cannot be accepted on equal terms, there is no place here for you. You cannot go into the North or the West without arousing the growing feeling of hostility toward you. The South must also have a homogeneous population, and any attempt to give the freed men equal status in the South will bring disaster to both races."
Amen to that.
He nailed it, didn't he?
Yeah, he sure did.
Reverend Edwin Thomas, the chairman of the black delegation, informed the president in a letter of August 16th that while he had originally opposed colonization, after becoming acquainted with the facts, he now favored it. He asked Lincoln's authorization to travel among his black friends and co-workers to convince them of the virtues of this emigration. And I'll tell you what, we'll stop here.
Yeah.
Because it's a good place to stop with the article. We have about 5 minutes left in the show, Eli. If you want to move on to any comments,
well, take the floor and do so. Yeah, where was Marcus Garvey when we really needed him?
Right.
Because he headed the Back to Africa movement in the 20th century in America. But he was undercut by the ADL and the NAACP, both of which were Jewish organizations. The Jews wanted blacks here in America to use them as counter-revolutionaries, or actually revolutionaries in favor of both communism and racial integration, because those two always go hand in hand. Okay, so this was a very intelligent black man who realized the situation. And he was undercut by the Jews. A lot of people don't realize that he was a very powerful movement, and the Jews gave him absolutely zero support.
Right, yeah. There was a split with the blacks, and unfortunately the Back to Africa nationalists lost out, and the other side that we know today with the the Martin Luther King Jr.'s and the Civil Rights Movement, 100 years after the Civil War, they won out. And make no mistake, folks, that was not blacks doing it themselves.
That's right.
That was a Jewish organization and Jewish money and effort behind the whole Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah, so that actually started the Second Civil War, right, which we are experiencing right now with blacks assuming that they are equal participants in our government, which they are not. Okay? And they went around subverting the Congress and subverting our laws to do the same. Now, for example, one of the worst incidents in the 20th century was when Eisenhower and who was the Jewish Supreme Court justice then, who was actually a rabbi, they both sent armed federal troops to the South in order to forcibly, at gunpoint and knife point, integrate the schools. Okay? Totally unconstitutional action by Eisenhower and that Supreme Court justice. And that Supreme Court justice was a total communist. His whole career was rooted in communism. I can't think of his name right now. But, yeah, that's the reality. So, again, the Second Civil War was started when the Democrats, primarily the Democrats, started fomenting for racial integration in the modern era.
It's funny you bring up Dwight D. Eisenhower, the terrible Swedish Jew from the West Point yearbook that he was in. And I remember reading years ago, several people pointed this out, his mother was apparently of a Negress phenotype. And that's why, I guess if you look up pictures, you will not find Dwight and his siblings pictures with the mother.
Right.
This was the embarrassing family secret of Dwight Eisenhower, that his mother was a Negress.
Right. So he has to cover that up. And, he's a crypto Jew. He was a bona fide crypto Jew pretending to be white, and the American people were none the wiser. So that happens all the time. And, of course, one more comment. The same is true of the French prime minister who had a non-disclosure agreement, Justin Trudeau, that he actually raped a high school girl while he was a teacher at the academy. And she settled out of court, or actually not out of court, but settled with a non-disclosure agreement so that the Canadians don't know about this. Okay. It has recently come out since the Republicans, the conservatives of Canada, are getting ready to take over. So bye-bye, Justin Trudeau. Bye-bye, Justin Trudeau. Okay, folks, thanks for listening. Thank you, Ted, for narrating. And I think we have at least one more episode on this document by the IHR, really exposing the fact that Abraham Lincoln was a total segregationist and not an integrationist in any way, shape, or form. Okay. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you, Pastor Eli.
Okay. All right.
God bless you all. Yeah.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.